This is a production of Cornell University.
So I've just heard from Brandon that he's having some Wi-Fi issues. So let's go ahead and let's see. Jacob, do you want to do roll call, or can we help do roll call, or can you?
Yeah, absolutely. Just give me 1 second so I can get up the agenda on my end.
Okay.
10 seconds. All right.
I'm happy to do. Do you have the roll call sheet?
I do not.
Okay. Do I do roll call?
Yeah. Sure. Okay. Yeah. I thought it was. I don't have that here. I thought it was in the box, but I'm not seeing it right now. So let's start off with the roll call real quick.
Okay, yeah, Casey. Okay, great. Thanks.
All right. Ian Acciolo.
Present.
Valerie Aymer.
Present.
Marcy Benda. Richard Benzel?
Here.
Duncan Cady?
Here.
Sorry, did someone say something?
Yeah, I'm here.
And Marcy is here as well.
I am. I'm sorry. I didn't unmute myself.
Okay. Nicola Dana?
Present.
Eve DeRosa?
Here.
Jacob Fite?
Here.
Brendan Fortenberry? Is here, but okay, is here. Thomas Fox?
Here.
Preston Hanley?
Here.
David Heiner?
Here.
Deborah Howell?
Here.
Caroline Levine? Caroline Levine? Manai Lewis?
Here.
Annalie Anonye?
Here.
James Richards? Damien Sharp? Jessica Withers?
Here.
Okay, perfect. So that's 17 out of 20. Counting Brendan Fortenberry.
Awesome. Sounds good with that. If nobody has anything else, nobody else is here. We're going to move into a land acknowledgement real quick. So Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayagono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayagono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University in New York State and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of the Gayagono disposition and honor the ongoing connection of the Gayagono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. All right. And now, quick call for late additions to the agenda. Seeing none, but also seeing that Brandon is now visible here. Brandon, are you ready to take over?
I'm back. Sorry about that, folks. My interwebs has been challenging this week. But here we are. So welcome, everyone. Sorry for that. Jacob, how far did we get along here?
I just finished the land acknowledgement and asked for any late additions to the agenda, and I don't see any. So I think you're good to take us through.
All right, great. Well, I appreciate it. Thanks. Sorry about the misstep there. Welcome back, everyone. Happy New Year. Glad to have you all back. I just want to acknowledge that, you know, we are in a different format than we have been before. We were able to finish out the semester in a hybrid format, but coming back, starting out in a Zoom session, which I know all of our folks in the student groups and faculty members are doing so with their courses. So felt important for us to follow suit and set up this first one as a Zoom meeting. I just want to acknowledge that I've seen numbers that look very promising for us to be able to return back to normal in the near future. So that is great to see. And looking forward to us being able to get back into 401 Physical Sciences. And Richard, I just want to report that I did connect with Tracy about the clock, and she has told me that it will be there when we return. So we'll find out if we have a welcome back gift there at 401 Physical Sciences. All right. Well, welcome, everyone. Let's jump right in. First up on our agenda, now that we don't have any late additions, it would be our meeting minutes. So I would entertain a motion to amend or approve our meeting minutes from 11/30/2021, which are linked in the agenda. And just a reminder for some of us who haven't been on the Zoom piece for a little while, been in person, you can raise your hand using the reaction button. If you have your camera on and physically raise your hand, I'll keep an eye out for that as well. Yes, Richard.
Move to approve the minutes. Is that what we're doing?
That's what we're doing. Is that what you're
all
doing?
Right, there's a motion.
All right, we have a motion. Do we have a second? Yes, Eve.
Second to approve the minutes.
We have a... Thank you. Second to approve the minutes. Any objections to approval of the minutes? All right. Seeing none, the meeting minutes are approved. All right. Next up in our agenda, I would like to just go over a few of our upcoming visits so folks are aware of what we have coming up, and then we'll bring some folks up here. Upcoming visits, we have our Earth Source Heat Group are here today and the Cornell University Borehole Observatory. At our next meeting on February 8th, we'll have the Public Safety Advisory Committee joining us. February 22nd, President Pollack will be joining us. We will follow the same format as last semester in asking folks to submit questions in advance via a Qualtrics survey that will go out. We do have a timeline that we have to meet to get those questions 1 week in advance to the president. I think we had limited questions last time. I'd love to see more questions for the president in advance to be able to provide some perspectives and thoughts. And then on March 8th, we have the Office of Student Conduct and Community Standards. This group is the group that is overseeing the Student Code of Conduct. We, as an assembly, we decided it would be good to have them join us this semester as opposed to last semester. So they would be able to give us some feedback on how things have been in implementing that new student code of conduct and us to be able to ask any questions. I definitely would encourage, all of you, specifically those from the student and the graduate student assembly, perspectives from their constituencies on how that's going, how students feel the administering of the conduct standards is going, if there's any questions, thoughts, or concerns around that, to hear from those folks. We did have to reschedule our visit from the University Signage Group just due to we were hoping to have them come on February 22nd, but they weren't able to because President Pollack's schedule. So we're going to rework that and try to have them come and join us here. There's a goal to improve and make enhancements to university signage here on campus. And then Liz Davis Frost has contacted us around Free Period Product Initiative. Would like to come and present, and I believe we'll be working with Liz to see if we can find a time frame to schedule that visit. All right, any questions or thoughts or concerns around the upcoming visits from folks? All right, seeing none, we'll move into our new business. And I see here we have the ombudsman appointment listed first. I couldn't remember which one was first, but if the folks from the Kubo team are okay if we do that piece first, unless you have a strict timeline to get out at a certain time. I could just get a thumbs up from those folks there. Okay, good. Okay, all right, so with that, Jacob or Gina, do we know if the letter was attached in the meeting agenda? I don't have it here from the president.
I actually don't know, but I can find out.
I don't believe it was, but, you know, quite frankly, I'm not sure it's necessary.
Yeah. So just want to let everyone know, we did receive a letter from President Pollack. As for those who recall, we had appointed Duncan to join the search committee for the university ombudsperson to join that search committee and talk to the candidates. And what I would like to do is perhaps turn it over to Duncan, if you would like to say anything, and then we can bring up talk about the vote for that appointment.
Yeah, a very flattering letter, I might add. Just joking. It's a very basic letter from President Pollack. I served on the Ombuds Search Committee along with Eve. I'd say it was a lot of fun. I don't know. I'm not sure how she'd categorize it. Okay, yeah, getting the nod of approval. Yeah, it was a great process. We had some great candidates, and we made our recommendations, and you know, it's really exciting to see this kind of come to its natural conclusion, and I'm happy to see Bruce here. So, yeah, I don't really prepare anything for this except to say that, you know, it was a good process. Two really qualified candidates, both had really really great applications. I loved getting to know both of them, and I think the Ombuds office is in a really unique position, but it's a very exciting time there. I don't know if Eve has anything to add to that.
No, I'm so happy to see Bruce here, and that's all I have to say as well. It was actually a really great process.
All right. Well, thank you, Duncan and Eve. So I just want to recap for folks that we have a letter from President Pollack from the Ombuds Search Committee to recommend Professor Bruce Lewinstein as the upcoming ombudsperson. I'll share my screen so you can see just the letter that was submitted. So we have that here presented. Did I share the right screen? All right, there we go. Just a brief outline there that President Pollack pleased to recommend Professor Bruce Lewinstein, Department of Communication in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, be appointed as the university ombudsperson for a 2-year renewable term. The Ombuds Search Committee was impressed by Professor Lewinstein's vision and enthusiasm for the role, as well as his experience with mediation. In addition to his teaching and research, Professor Lewinstein has served on the University Faculty Committee and on various committees across the university, has been both member and speaker of the University Faculty Senate. Professor Lewinstein also served as faculty elected trustee on the Cornell Board of Trustees from 2016 to 2020. His extensive experience makes him particularly well suited for the role of university ombudsperson. University Assembly Representative Duncan Cady was an engaged member of the search committee that reviewed the potential candidates. I appreciate the time and attention Duncan dedicated to this important process and look forward to the concurrence of the University Assembly on this appointment. So with that being said, I would welcome Professor Lewinstein, if you would like to make any statements or additions to comments to the University Assembly here.
Thanks, Brandon. I appreciate the invitation to be here and to really, so I can answer any questions. I appreciated Duncan and Eve's role on the search committee and talking with them. Just for those who don't know me, I'm a faculty member. I've been here for almost 35 years. I have a funny appointment. My primary appointment is in the Ag School, but I'm also a full member of a department in the Arts College, so I sit on both sides of the public-private line at Cornell. I've been on the usual range of committees, which means I've dealt with people across campus, obviously faculty and students, but also I've been involved in some staff activities. So I know less of that than other things, that's certainly an area that I'm looking forward to getting to know. The Ombuds Office has a long tradition. We were one of the first comprehensive ombuds offices at a university, major university in the United States. The last 10 years, Charlie Walcott has done a wonderful job. I see Tracy Brandt, who's one of the staff, the assistant ombuds in the office, is here on the screen with me. My own instinct as a former speaker of the Senate, as a member of the Board of Trustees, has been to try to see the whole university and to try to find the places where and resolve disputes in less formal ways and serve the entire community. I'd be glad to answer any questions that people have about my my vision for the role or any other issues that come up.
Thank you, Professor Lewinstein. I would welcome any questions or comments that folks may like to add here. Again, if you want to just raise your physical hand or raise your Zoom hand, either way. Yes, Thomas.
Yeah. Hi, Bruce. Glad you're doing this. When you say your vision for the role, I always imagined the Ombuds Office was essentially a reactive sort of entity and not proactive. Am I correct in that?
That is absolutely. The primary role is reactive. There are a couple of things, though, that we can be a little bit more upfront about. One is simply making sure the Ombuds Office is well known. So part of the vision is actually being a little more aggressive about being out there, being communicating what the office does, what our role is, enhancing our visibility. The other thing is that there already informally there are good connections between the Ombuds Office and other kinds of conflict resolution groups on campus, the Scheinman Institute, the intergroup dialogue group, and so on. There's all those connections. And I'd like to see that be a little bit more robust so that we can perhaps try to create an atmosphere of conflict resolution on campus that perhaps can get out ahead of some issues or help us resolve the kinds of conflicts we sometimes have on campus. And then finally, something that the office already does, but that is part of my own vision, is not just to be reacting to individual cases, but when we see patterns of cases, to reach out to appropriate offices on campus and talk about the patterns that we see and see if there's, we're not the ones to recommend or change policies, but just to say, here's an issue that I think other people ought to be aware of. And we can do that as well in some of our public reports. We have an annual report and other things.
Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Bruce. Recognize Richard.
Yeah, I'm glad you're doing this, Bruce. You just alluded to one of the things that I would mention, which is that when you do see patterns of conflict and they can be resolved, you know, one of the ways this might facilitate reform would have your office report to the University Assembly those patterns so that we might also discuss and recommend action on them. I think this has been one of the things in the periodic and the annual reports and so forth that the Ombudsman has made. Reminded, but I don't think we've ever had a report like that. So, you know, aside from those annual visits. So anyway, I'd encourage that because one of the things the University Assembly lives on is information, and you're going to be on the front line.
Thanks, Richard. Yeah, no, that would absolutely. I mean, the part of this sort of enhanced visibility that I envision is having regular meetings with groups like the Assembly and the other Assembly, I mean, but all of the Assemblies, the University Assembly, but also the Employee Assembly, Student Assembly, and Faculty Senate to talk about what we're seeing, what kinds of issues are coming up, and to reinforce that we are there for people to turn to when they're looking for a confidential, informal, neutral site for resolving issues. I forgot to mention, by the way, one tidbit, which is this is actually a return for me. I was the student ombudsman at my undergraduate university, so this is a role that I've known about for longer than most people know about an ombuds role, and I'm really looking forward to returning to it.
Thank you for the question, Richard, and thank you, Professor Lewinstein, for that answer there. I would echo the statements there, appreciate the statements around amplifying the visibility. As a staff member, I think the only time that I've heard someone mention the utilization was when I was into a challenging situation already, as opposed to being able to look at it as an opportunity to address early on and seek guidance earlier. So I really appreciate that perspective as well. Any other questions or comments from the assembly? Oh, go ahead, Jacob.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems as though, as a co-host, I don't have access to the raised hands, but that's fine. So first of all, thank you very much, Bruce, for being here. I mean, as we continue to trend into this seeming uncertain future, it might be a little bit unfair to ask you about some of the issues that the Ombudsman Office may be facing in the future. But I do want to ask you, and I'm glad that you brought up the fact that and of course I didn't know this, that you were a student ombudsman at your undergraduate university or institution there, rather. So how do you see the office, if you are the university ombudsman, becoming more accessible to folks of very different backgrounds, very different needs? And how are you going to address those evolving accessibility concerns moving forward?
Well, you know, thanks, Jacob, for that question. So some of it is just, you know, having a communication plan, getting, being out at meetings, being sure that we have posters up, that we have social media presence of some kind. We don't want to be too aggressive there, but something we've talked about possibly having, putting on our website a blog that might have, this is an idea that Tracy had actually, a blog that would talk about some of the things that we can do and so forth. So again, just sort of the higher visibility piece of it. One of the issues that we have to address is making sure that everybody on campus sees us as being a potential resource. And that means acknowledging some of the things that we are not, you know, that we're not the place to resolve the conflict, but also, you know, looking on this screen, I will, you know, acknowledging that I'm an older white male and that means I have to make a special effort to make sure that people who don't see themselves literally in me will see us as a potential resource. So that might mean making some special outreach to different kinds of groups on campus, whether those are racial or ethnic or particular subgroups within the main assemblies or so on. And that's where I think we can be a little more active in being sure that it's not just people coming to us, but we're making sure that we're out there and people recognize the opportunities that we can offer.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Bruce. Any other questions or comments? If there are none, I would entertain a motion to vote to approve the appointment by the president for the university ombudsperson.
I motion to approve the appointment of...
And I second.
Yeah.
Thank you. We have a motion by Duncan and seconded by Nick. With that, we can vote on approval. For those that are... We haven't done a Zoom vote in a little while, but it's in the reaction buttons there. You have the green check mark to vote yes. All those in favor? And, all right, and any opposed would press the red check mark. Casey, how are you doing with tracking this?
I counted 16 before they started disappearing, so.
Okay, and then. Yeah. If we could clear the votes and any abstentions, if everyone can just click that green check mark to clear it. And do we have any abstentions? Jacob, I still see yours is up, but that's from the vote of yes. Is that correct? Yep.
Yeah. Right, so that's yes.
Okay. So see, I don't think I see any. Casey? No. So with 16, that.
16-4.
We have 16, a unanimous approval for the appointment by the president for Professor Bruce Lewinstein as the university ombudsperson. Welcome. Very excited. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your support. I appreciate it. And obviously, if anyone wants to reach out to me, please do so. Look forward to working with you.
Absolutely. And thank you for joining. And Bruce, please feel free to stay on. I know you had mentioned you might want to watch the presentation about Earth Source Heat and the Kubo team.
That's the real reason I'm here. I want to find out more about Earth Source Heating.
Well, congratulations, Professor Lewinstein. Very happy to have you in the role and look forward to working with you in the future. With that, then, we'll move on to the next item on our agenda. And I will welcome up our Sarah Carson, a director of sustainability here at Cornell University, and allow for Sarah to then introduce the rest of the team presenting. Welcome, Sarah.
Great. Thanks, Brandon. Really happy to be here with this super fun team. Brandon, or whoever's the host, may I share my screen? So I'm here today with three other members of the team that are working on Cornell's Earth Source Heat project. And let's see if I successfully shared my screen. Maybe like a thumbs up. Okay, great. So I'm here today with Ole Gustafson, who's a professional geologist working with the academic folks and who I've worked with for a long time on the facility side as well. Tony Ingraffia, a faculty member. Tony maybe has a legend of his own, defies too much introduction, but he's been active in the community for a long time around what is commonly known as fracking, and also has a lot of academic expertise in the technologies of drilling and things that are going to be associated with the project. And also we'll hear from Terry Jordan, another faculty member, professor of engineering, a geologist in earth and atmospheric sciences. So we are here today to talk to you, as it says, about Earth Source Heat and the Cornell University Borehole Observatory, which is the first really tangible phase to the community. There will be a drill rig, as you see pictured in here, on campus, we hope, in May. It'll be quite noticeable, as it is approximately the size of McGraw Tower. The drill rig just be there temporarily, but we want to talk to you about what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're doing it, and then answer any questions that you may have. So I'm going to give you a quick overview as director of a campus sustainability office to kind of inform you how this project fits in with our broader goal to have this campus be carbon neutral by 2035. And then just a quick overview of what Earth Source Heat is, and then Terry and Ole are going to give you the details, and Tony's going to help us answer any questions that you may have. All right, so why are we doing this? As I said, we have a goal for this campus to be carbon neutral by 2035. We set that goal back in 2007, and a big part of that being carbon neutral means that we need to find different ways to heat, power, and cool our buildings that don't result in greenhouse gas emissions. So we're not using fossil fuels, we're not using refrigerants, that kind of thing. So we have already successfully completed a lake source cooling project. Lots of information online, and happy to follow up with anybody who has questions about that. But that's been up and running for, 21 years now. Very successfully reduced the electricity it takes to cool the campus by more than 90%. We're working hard on renewables, mostly solar at this point, augmenting the hydro plant that's already on campus. We're at about 20% net annual renewable electricity for the campus. And fun fact, on sunny afternoons, at any given point in time, our renewables, both the solar farms and hydro, are generating 100% of our power, sort of real time. But we have ways to go for net annual usage. And the biggest challenge that we have left then is heating our campus. Heat accounts for about 30% of campus greenhouse gas emissions at this point. Finding a way to heat the place in a cold climate without burning something really is a challenge. So this is where Earth Source Heat comes in. If we're successful, we can do this without using fossil fuels, without dramatically increasing our use of electricity, and without using refrigerants. And to put this in a little more scale for you, if we can do this, this reduces overall Tompkins County emissions by about 7%. So we help our community on the path to their goals as well. One of the really great things about Earth Source Heat is that we can leverage the existing heating infrastructure in our buildings. And a lot of the infrastructure, sorry, my dog is a little noisy in the background, thanks for that. In a way that demonstrates what a new solution that can scale beyond our own campus. So to that end, really sorry about the dog noises. I hope you can't hear that. what exactly is our source heat? So it is our vision for a campus-wide geothermal heating system that would leverage the heat that is stored in the Earth's crust. We would feed it into our campus district energy system. Our campus has a central generation of heat, power, and cooling that we then distribute through a network of pipes and wires to all the buildings on campus. So we would leverage that system. It's the most efficient way to do things. And we would drill two or more deep wells. And by deep, we mean really deep, two, three miles down into the earth where it's hot. Mostly we have hot rocks, and Terry Noly will explain this in more detail, but we would circulate water through these wells. The water would go down, get warmed up down there in the earth. We'd suck it back up through this heat exchanger facility at the surface, where it would transfer its heat into a separate loop of water that would then circulate around the campus to heat our buildings. So that is it at a high level. It really replicates the system that we've already developed for lake source cooling, at least in terms of how the surface facilities work. So why would we do this? Why would we not just put in heat pumps like everybody else? We think that at Cornell, what we can really do as an institution of higher education and as a research institution is to leverage the expertise of the faculty members that we have here on campus, as well as our staff members, to create what is really sort of a game-changing new solution that we can then demonstrate and scale out to the rest of the world. We really desperately need solutions that don't involve just a lot of electrification for heating. You may or may not be aware of the challenges that we're experiencing trying to develop renewable electricity to meet our existing needs. We've calculated that if we were to use the ground source heat pumps, kind of the traditional technology that a lot of residences use or small commercials use, that we might as much as quadruple our electricity needs in the winter. And Earth Source Heat doesn't have that implication. So it's really important for us to create these new solutions versus just taking care of our own campus footprint in traditional ways. We think we can really add to the overall global solution set by doing that. As I already said, taking care of our emissions helps the county on its goals. And the other great thing about Earth Source Heat is that it's what we call a base load heating solution. So that heat is always there. It doesn't matter if the sun is shining or the wind is blowing, or we have a drought, which sometimes affects sources of renewable electricity. So this that's another key aspect of Earth Source Heat that we think is an important addition. Okay, so with that introduction, I'm going to hand it over to you, Terry, to tell us a little bit more about the upcoming next step, which is KUBO.
Thank you, Sarah. And thanks for inviting us. So Sarah has laid out what we hope to achieve when we have a fully functional Earth Source Heat system providing campuses needs. But we actually have a lot of technical questions to answer before a huge investment is made in this geothermal system. The questions range from, can a geothermal energy system at any price provide sufficient heat to meet our climate action goals for the campus? And can it do it at an acceptable price? So We have the technical question and we have the cost question. How long would what we'll call a reservoir of heat, a geothermal reservoir, how long could that sustain the heating? You wouldn't want to invest all that money, find out that 2 years down the line, it no longer was producing what you need. So we need to build time into the model of what will be the outcomes so that wise decisions can be made. And then there's also a host of questions about whether there may be unintended consequences that are unacceptable risks, and can those be mitigated? Can we do something differently so that they never occur? So we can't answer what the level of risk is without knowing something about the subsurface that we don't yet know. All of these are questions we ask, but we don't have answers to. Sarah, next, please. So what we're doing is starting with a single borehole, which is now the yellow straw in this diagram, which we're calling the Cornell University Borehole Observatory, which is to get answers. It's what you might call finding out whether your model of all the good that could happen matches the reality of what's on the ground or under the ground. So we'll find out a lot more about what might be the performance characteristics by going into the rocks through drilling and sampling, observing, testing what is underneath there and its capacity. With that, we can make better estimates of what the heat production may be and how long it might last. We can provide much better answers to questions about risks and benefits and how risks and benefits trade off against each other. And we'll have vital information we will obtain from this well, vital information in order to design a functional earth source heat reservoir system and the top side, the engineering of the heat exchangers and those sorts of things. So Kubo's goal, Cornell University Borehole Observatory, is to answer the questions that need answers before we're in a position for the university to make decisions. Next, please. How do we get data out of a borehole that, in this case, we're planning a borehole that's about 2 miles deep, which is 3,000 meters. And I'm not traveling down that borehole to sample the rocks or sample the fluids, but our objective is to measure what we call the geophysical properties of the rocks, to learn whether the rocks were just, you know, wonderfully homogeneous or they're fractured, which is very useful because water will flow well through fractures and not so well through homogeneous rock. I should say, how do we get the heat out of the ground? This is a bit of the principle going back to what Sarah had said. We need to have water remove the heat and deliver the heat to the surface. So this water circulating through the rocks is very important, and fractures are probably what the water would circulate through. The borehole can provide us with samples, physical samples of the rocks. It can provide us with physical samples of what the natural in situ fluids are, which are down there. And then we can do a variety of tests on the rocks. One says hydrogeologic tests. That means learning whether water can be sucked out of those rocks by using pumps, and at what horizons what depth of horizons that could happen. We're very interested in what the mechanical state of the rocks is beneath there, because that informs how we design a heat extraction system, and it informs what the risks might be. So there'll be tests of the stresses. And then we will leave as monitors after the initial well operation is completed. We'll leave in that well a fiber optic temperature sensor system so that long term, we can find out how temperatures vary with depth and maybe vary through time in the borehole. And we will install a seismometer. Seismometers measure the vibrations in the earth, and a seismometer buried 2,000 meters or a mile and a half down there will be far more sensitive to vibrations in the earth than our seismometers, which are up near the surface where there's all this human noise and other kind of atmospheric noises mixed in. So this is the sort of like the scientist and engineer's list of data we're trying to get out of it, out of the exploration well. And next, Sarah. This is what our well will look like, or it is designed to look like. And this is a strip map sort of with Earth surface up at the top where it's green for the lawns. And we go down the 2 miles, 10,000 feet to the very bottom. And it has all these interesting color variations because those are representing the rock interval types as we go downward. When you're up at the top of the well in the top 100 to 200 feet, it'll look just like the rocks that we would see if we go to visit Taganic Park or you take a walk in the gorge. But as you go deeper and deeper, we'll get into various known rock units. For instance, marked on there are a couple of dark gray ones. We'll be at about 1,500 feet and around just above 7,000 feet. Those are the Marcellus Shale and the Utica Shale. Those in Pennsylvania are being used as gas-producing units, but they only produce gas when they're heavily fractured. So here in our simple borehole, we're not going to really be in that situation. Another unit marked in there at around 3,000 feet deep is the Syracuse Salt Bed. That's the interval of rocks which are being mined. If you go up near Lansing to the salt mines there, that rock unit is also beneath us at about 3,000 feet deep. Through that top interval, everything I've talked about so far, there will be a steel casing, basically a steel shell, installed into the well and cemented into it. And you can ask Tony or Oli questions about the cementing if you'd like. But essentially, that means that the borehole interior is isolated, separated from the rocks and the natural fluids and natural gases that might be in the rocks by this steel case and the cement around it. At the very bottom of the well, though, I should say the bottom kilometer distance there from around 7,500 feet, not quite that deep, downward, we're really interested in that interval being the rocks that are hot enough above 70, 75 degrees Celsius. I should do this in Fahrenheit. Down at the bottom of the well, we expect it to be around 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which is not boiling, but it's very hot. That's the interval of rock where having water extract that heat from the rock, bring it back up through a future well, not through this test well, but through the future system, that would bring us hot enough water to be a great booster to heating the campus. So in that bottom interval, essentially where it's brown and gray at the bottom, we're going to be doing all sorts of tests of what is the capacity of those rocks to transmit water, what is the distribution of fractures in those rocks, and that'll be the place where we're doing tests because we're really interested in creating later, after decisions are made to do this, to create a reservoir for geothermal heat. And if you want to see what it will be like drilling down through these and stopping and putting in that telescope and casing system, there is a really nice animation that the university illustrators have made, which is on the Earth Source Heat webpage front. It's on the main page. And then, Sarah, next slide, and I'll be kicking it over. So I want to end by saying that it is not being drilled next to McGraw Tower, despite the comparison of heights there. It's way over on the east side of campus, east of the apple orchards. And then I'll turn it over to Oli here.
Great. Thanks, Terry. And thanks, everybody, for inviting us to present this information to you. Very exciting project that we're really happy to be a part of. And I guess I'll just start off, you know, this slide says located for minimal environmental impact. So any technology to produce energy has some sort of environmental impact, whether it be, you know, large fields of solar panels or wind farms or hydroelectric facilities. And one reason we're interested in this geothermal heating idea is that we feel its environmental impacts are relatively low compared to other options available for renewable energy. And but that doesn't mean there's no impact. And we've gone into this with very careful consideration and planning for what the impacts might be and how we can be a model at Cornell for doing a project like this in a way that minimizes any environmental impacts. The technology to drill down to 10,000 feet is essentially the same technology that's used for oil and gas production. That large drill rig is the same kind of rig that they use in Pennsylvania to drill gas wells. And, you know, there have been examples of environmental problems with oil and gas production, oil and gas drilling operations. And so what we're doing is quite a bit different than those projects, but there are some similarities as well. And we want to make sure that we're very careful to do this in a way that is as safe as possible. So this slide here shows our location where we are going to drill this test borehole out off the Palm Road area. It's surrounded by kind of what we call Cornell's back of house operations, which is things like warehousing and bus maintenance and the grounds facilities and environmental health and safety storage areas and things like that. So it's a good location because it's very close to campus, so that ultimately if we do progress to a heat production system, we can tie it into our campus heating systems. But it's not too close. You know, on this slide, it shows, you know, the nearest academic buildings are over 2,000 feet away. Nearest residence is also about 2,000 feet away on, to the south across Cascadilla Creek. And there are no drinking water wells nearby. The nearest ones are about a mile away on the other side of the creek. So, you know, that just means that it's an area where the drilling operation itself will be as a minimum disruption possible to be for a location that's, you know, accessible to campus. Go ahead to the next slide. So here's a little bit of a close-up image of that Palm Road area. And some of the areas of environmental impact that we've assessed, and one of the reasons, and some of the reasons why we like this site, it's already a developed site, so we're not going out into some greenfield somewhere and clearing a bunch of land to drill. The drilling operation itself is expected to last about 8 weeks, and that's most of the impacts associated with this whole concept have to do with the drilling itself. You know, especially for this test borehole phase where we're not going to be pumping water to produce heat yet. You know, it's pretty much just the drill rig operations itself that we need to consider for impacts. Noise is an issue. Drilling projects can be pretty noisy, but new drill rig technology has allowed us to ask for a electric rig that doesn't have big diesel motors on it. And that really helps to reduce the noise generated by these operations. And there's a number of other aspects to the drilling where we are working with potential drilling firms that we would hire to make sure that you know, they keep their operation as quiet and, you know, minimize the disruption as much as possible. There will be some truck traffic bringing in the rig itself, which comes in many pieces and gets put together on site, and also the other equipment, all the steel pipe and the cement that Terry was talking about that's needed. But that would be similar to truck traffic for any construction project around campus. much less than the kind of truck traffic that's often seen around drilling projects for oil and gas production. But we won't need to truck in water. They do use water for mixing up drilling mud and cement and things for the operation, but we can use our own campus water that's available on site. And we want to make sure that lighting is done in an appropriate way, that the lights on the rig are focused downward to where the workers need them, but that, you know, they're shining all over the place and being disruptive during night time, because this will be a 24-hour a day drilling operation. And then once we have finished this 10,000-foot borehole and installed all the pipe in the ground and cemented it in, and it'll be in place for testing, all that will be left at the end will be a pipe sticking out of the ground with probably a little pot next to it for researchers to keep some equipment in or something like that. So it won't be a very obtrusive thing after we're finished drilling. Go ahead to the next one. So this is a little bit more detail about the construction. Terry already showed some of this on the previous slide, but you can see that the different sections of the well are drilled kind of in a telescoping manner. You start out wider at the top, and then you put in an initial pipe in the ground, and then you go within that pipe to go the next section down. And then each stage, as you go down, you set another pipe in the ground and cement it in place. And that just helps to keep the hole stable and to isolate the shallow groundwater zones from any deeper zones where you might have, say, natural gas present or something. We want to keep all those zones sealed off and separate from each other. Next slide. So a little bit about our environmental monitoring. So we do not expect, especially with a exploration borehole like this, where we're primarily just testing the rock and taking samples, we think the potential for any kind of groundwater contamination is very low. But there, with any kind of operation with a lot of equipment, there could be just a surface spill of fuel or something, or and anything like that that could affect groundwater resources, we want to make sure we're keeping an eye on those things. So we've already installed some monitoring wells for groundwater at the four corners of this parcel. Some of them are shallow, some are deeper, to monitor different zones of the shallow groundwater in the area. So that will just allow us, if for some reason there were an unexpected release of materials from the operations, we would be able to see it in these monitoring wells before it migrated to, say, the creek or something. And we will also collect samples from Cascadilla Creek during the operations, both upstream and downstream of the site, so we can kind of compare water quality and make sure we're not impacting the creek. We also plan to have noise monitors at the perimeter of the site. As I mentioned, the noise should be relatively subdued given the noise mitigation efforts that we're implementing, but we want to make sure that we're not causing noise levels that are unacceptable. And lastly, I want to talk a little bit about seismic monitoring. Can you go to the next slide? So there's been examples from oil and gas operations of drilling and wells causing earthquakes. Mostly that has to do with large-scale fluid injection into the ground, wastewater disposal, in locations where there was seismic potential stresses, faults with stress on them that were able to be kind of activated by this fluid injection. And we are not in that kind of a situation at all here. We're in a very seismically quiet area, and we're not going to be disposing of large volumes of wastewater in the ground. So, you know, that's not something we expect to encounter at all, but we still want to make sure that we understand what's going on seismically and that we can monitor it during drilling to make sure we're not disturbing anything. So toward that end, we installed over the past few years a network of seismometers that are shown on this map, the blue circles, and they go. Cayuga Lake is that curvy thing on the left, and these borehole, these seismometers are installed in holes in the ground, or either shallow pits or drilled holes. they extend up into Lansing and then, you know, around the Ithaca area and over to the west side of the lake a little bit, out towards Dryden a little ways. So this network is allowing us to monitor very low level natural seismic events, as well as human made vibrations as well. Like these sensors pick up things like construction projects and traffic noise and things like that that cause vibrations in the ground. So we're using this to make sure we understand any natural and human caused background levels of we call micro seismicity, these small vibrations, so that during our drilling operations, we can see if there's any change to that. And if we inadvertently were causing some sort of seismic activity, we could detect it and we could figure out why and make sure we corrected it. Next slide. So this last slide here is just a picture from a couple of other geothermal drilling projects over in Europe that we stuck in here just to give an idea of what these drill sites look like. The one on the left, a street view from a project in Germany. And then the one on the right is a satellite overhead view of a drilling operation at University of Finland, right in Helsinki, where they squeezed their drilling operation into the parking lot of their heating plant. And ours is going to be more like the one on the left, a couple of acres of the parking lot at Palm Road will be dedicated to this. And so that gives a little bit of an idea of what the project might look like while it's happening. And once we do start drilling, which we expect will be in maybe May of this year, we're working on getting all our contracts in place and getting things lined up. Anybody who's interested, we're going to have a setup where people can come and see the drill rig operating and talk to those of us who are involved with the project with any questions. So hopefully there will be a lot of interest in this and a lot of excitement at this step forward in our carbon neutrality goals. And we hope to talk to more of you about it if you have any questions.
And that is the end of our presentation. And we're happy to take questions in any time that's left.
Thank you very much, Sarah and team. I really appreciate it. I've had the opportunity to hear from folks a few times, so I'll turn the floor over to folks. We already have some good questions, I'm sure. So I will start it off there and recognize Thomas.
Yeah, I asked this in another context once earlier, but I actually used to live in Basel in Switzerland, and I know they started a project like this there. And of course, that is a seismically active area, and the city was destroyed 700 years ago, so they were very concerned. But they actually did have some problems and stopped the project, as I understand it. And I'm wondering if you could explain why that happened and maybe why we shouldn't expect anything like that. That's after you start pumping water down, I assume, and drawing the heat up.
Ollie, are you going to do that one?
Yeah, sure. I can answer that. They had a project, a geothermal project, you know, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago now, I suppose, that they were trying to circulate water down into a faulted area. And they did cause an earthquake that was, you know, relatively significant. It caused some minor damage to buildings and stuff. And it was definitely, that's probably the biggest, one of the biggest, certainly, examples of a problem with a geothermal project. And that's been studied quite extensively to understand why that happened and to make sure that, you know, it isn't repeated. And, you know, our site is in a very different type of geologic setting where we wouldn't have the potential for that sort of earthquake. But yeah, they definitely made some big mistakes when they developed that project.
Terry or Tony, you want to add any to that?
No, we're good.
Okay.
Good. If Thomas says it's good.
Yeah, no, I knew it was seismically active, but I didn't know the extent to which we're different, I guess.
Well, the other thing that happened is they drilled basically near the center of town. The town consisted of hundreds of beautifully wonderful old architecture.
Oh, I know.
That was very, very subject to relatively small seismic activity. And right. So you had a lot of cracking of old stone structures. We don't have that problem here. Our oldest buildings are on the campus.
White Hall. No, Morrill Hall, right.
The oldest. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it was the wrong thing to do in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Good. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Thomas, Olya, and Tony. Go ahead, Marcy.
Hi, yes. It sounds like a really great, sounds pretty neat. but as being one of the closest academic buildings, I work at the Vet College. I did see that it was also right close to the dairy barn. I assume the Vet College was, I'm not a veterinarian, but I assume they were consulted in, you know, any type of noise or seismic, you know, whatever, shaking wouldn't have any, you know, if there's any issues, what would be the, how would you stop or, you know, just wondering the impact of, I guess, the animals that they treat at the Vet College.
Yeah, I can address that. So, you know, we expect that this operation will not be any more disruptive to those in the vicinity than other types of operations that already occur in that area. We already have, you know, buses driving in and out and dump trucks dumping piles of gravel and all those kind of things. And so for the most part, the drilling will be similar to that. The vibrations from the drilling itself in the ground, we don't expect will be noticeable even very near the site, but certainly not at any distance. So yeah, we've looked at that, and you know, the synchrotron is over there. They have very, very sensitive tolerances on their equipment. But you know, our impact should be less than, say, the traffic that drives by on 366 in terms of vibration and noise levels.
Thank you, Oli. And I'll recognize Richard, and then Jacob had a question after Richard, and then I'll go to Ian.
Yeah, that one, this is fascinating. And it must be an incredible trip to have this drilling site and all this information and be able to play with it. This is a wonderful set of toys. I mean, an opportunity to experiment. I really love it. So here's a sort of a hypothetical question, because I studied those charts as they were passed by us, and I know nothing about this stuff, so I'm just speculating. But I saw you're going to go 10,000 feet, and at that level, you think the rock is going to be about 170 degrees or so, something like that. The question is, you go another, say, 1,000 or 1,200 feet or something, and the rock is at boiling temperature for water. So why don't you just go down that deep and have an internally what, prophylactic? That's not the word, but whatever, system. So you don't have to have the water traveling through the rock. You just send the water down, it boils, and it comes up. So that's my question. I may be incredibly flat-footed or something, but you know, that looking at your charts, that's what I thought you might do. So that's it.
Well, that's you've caught the inspiration of geothermal. And if it were less expensive to drill, then we would just keep going. So sort of like the plan is to drill till we run out of money, but we're more worried about running out of money than we think is practical for getting to the depths you're speaking of. Certainly, if we find that the rocks are amenable to going deeper, then we will. But the rocks are likely to be less suitable for moving water through them when you get significantly deeper than what we're planning. So we assume that there's going to be a trade-off between, you know, the likelihood of passing water through them and the improved temperature as we go deeper. But if it weren't so expensive, we would be going deeper just you know, without doubt.
Yeah, the second part of your question, Richard, about why don't you just dump cold water down the well and let it boil and get it back out? You have to have a return loop. You literally have to have either one well in the form of a U, a down and a back, or two wells, which are somehow interconnected by the natural fracture system. So the natural fracture system acts as a transport connecting the two wells. So yeah, you're going to dump cold water down one well, and hopefully it passes through the hot rock long enough to gather all the heat, and then it comes up the other well. So the possibility of drilling one continuous well down and back up, that's technically not possible at this point. Unless you hire the oil and gas people, they can do anything as long as you're willing to pay them billions of dollars.
Thanks. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that question. And I'll turn to Jacob now and then to Ian.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you all so much for being here. You know, from everybody from the Earth Source meeting and the Borehole Observatory team, I mean, your dedication to this project is critical, and it is not lost on us that this is truly transformational work here. You know, as an environment and sustainability major here at Cornell, the living laboratory vision of the campus sustainability office is phenomenal, and it's made my experience as an undergraduate student truly second to none with regard to environmental studies. And so, I've done quite a bit of research on earth source heating as part of my undergraduate education. So, of course, this has tremendous potential in achieving our campus sustainability goals. And, of course, the observatory is clearly critical in ensuring that this endeavor, you know, not only serves the practical purposes of the Cornell community, but perhaps more impactfully in ensuring that this endeavor serves as a critical informational resource for the future of sustainability initiatives across the country. But of course, because this initiative doesn't only serve to address our needs, right? It is a broader scientific endeavor trying to answer a lot of different unique questions associated with this specific renewable energy source. What immediate safety or remediation mechanisms beyond simply monitoring technology, as you all mentioned, are in place in the event of a potentially unanticipated, unintended environmental challenge posed? You know, to paraphrase a popular television commercial, what good is monitoring an issue without a means of actually addressing it? So that's my first question. And my other question, you know, was just brought up by your answers to the last question. I mean, I can't imagine this initiative not being completed due to a lack of money. I mean, I simply can't imagine building another baseball field or something as opposed to making sure this critical initiative is fully and well-funded. So do you all have enough money to complete the initiative as it stands in your current plans?
Can we quote you on that, by the way?
Sure.
He's a baseball fan, too. That's worth mentioning there.
Yeah, the problem with a project like this is you don't really know how much it's going to cost until you're in the middle of it. Drilling at these depths is inherently difficult and uncertain, and you can have problems where, you know, just things don't go as you think, and you lose a bit, or your bits are wearing out quicker, and whatever. So, we've made a guess, although, you know, even in, since we got our grant for this, all the prices for everything have gone up quite a bit. So we're already kind of looking at that. And, various people within Cornell, especially, the utilities, the, you know, energy and environmental office, are, you know, really stepping up to provide resources that are already filling in some of the need for areas where we discovered as we started, you know, contracting the work that that maybe we need a little bit more money. So, you know, the university is certainly behind this. Money's tight, so, you know, everybody's got needs, but we believe it won't be easy if we need to, you know, go and ask for more money from whatever sources, but we think the commitment's there to make sure this happens.
The other part of your question was about actually stopping problems, not just monitoring them. And I'm afraid I'm going to turn back to Oli to do that. But there are protocols that exist of, you know, you detect, you stop. No, you. So, but I'll let Oli go into
detail. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we, one of the, when we have the main companies hired, which will happen in the next couple of months, the drilling firm and the firms that do all the testing and monitoring services, we'll get all of them together and we'll develop a whole comprehensive series of, you know, health and safety and environmental protocols. And, you know, obviously that would mean like, you know, hey, if we start to see something happening in Cascadilla Creek, you know, what do we do? What does the level have to be of some disturbance before we, you know, take action of shutting down the whole project and, you know, figuring out what's going on? And those are not small questions because these rigs charge a daily rate. If we tell them to stop drilling, they're still charging us $20,000 a day, you know? So, you've always got that inherent tension between, you know, wanting to go as quickly as possible, but wanting to make sure you do it safely. And we are absolutely committed to doing it safely. And if we have to shut it down, we will. It would be a real bummer, but obviously good planning is what you hope will avoid having to make those kinds of choices.
And I guess I would just add to your point, Jacob, about the living lab. We have already learned so much about sort of the business end of one of these projects, as have, you know, our counterparts, you know, in the drilling industry. And I'm actually really, you know, excited. We've had some interesting dialogues with drillers who are, you know, have carbon neutrality goals of their own and who are really excited to be, you know, leveraging their assets towards a, you know, sort of an energy transition. That said, though, you know, they're used to doing business in a very different way than the university is used to doing business. So, you know, part of what we're, you know, figuring out and, you know, documenting in hopes that, you know, this can be replicated in other places, you know, are these business strategies, are the kinds of insurance, you know, that we need to purchase, you know, so that if we lose a bit, you know, can, you know, the insurance cover us to start over again, you know, some of those questions. So the whole thing has been, you know, a pretty big learning experience.
Thank you for the question, Jacob, and the answers there. And we'll take one more question from Ian, and then we'll close our presentation time.
Good afternoon. My question pertains to time frames in relation to answers to the questions that need answering. I'm wondering if there's an anticipated time frame necessary right now for data gathering before final determination can be made as to the final viability of Earth Source Heating as a power source for Cornell.
Well, we are very cognizant that to achieve a 2035 deadline, you know, we have to work back to, you know, to today and say, wow, we sort of need to already be starting to raise the money for the next more expensive part of a Earth Source Heat project. But you can't really be raising money until you answer the questions. So we're hoping that within 6 months to a year after the well is drilled, we'll have at least preliminary answers. We may not be very satisfied as you know, scientists and engineers that we have the error bars reduced on our answers, but we want within that time frame to be passing what we've learned forward to a design team, because you need someone to design what it will be like in order for you to evaluate how your design increases or diminishes risks and such, and the cost of it. So, you know, we sort of feel like there's a very high pressure on the rate of getting answers.
Thank you, Terry. Anyone else like to add anything to that? All right. Well, I want to thank our presenters today. It's fascinating stuff. I've had the opportunity to hear this presentation a few times, and I learn something more every time. So I really look forward to following along and seeing the progress of the project. Welcome you to send us updates as things go along, any things that we can share with the assembly here. So thank you so much for taking time to present. We really appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Have a good night.
Take care. And I just want to state for the record that I forgot to note that on the previous vote that there was one late addition on the votes. Damien Sharp came in late and did vote in affirmative for the appointment of Bruce Lewinstein, as well as I was having technical issues at the beginning in roll call, but Caroline Levine was not able to attend due to being overseas, but wanted to voice her support as well for the appointment of Bruce Lewinstein as the ombudsperson. So I want to make sure I stated that item. All right, we took a good chunk of time for the presentation, which I think was really great to do. I knew that we had the opportunity because many of the organizations haven't had a chance yet to meet or had limited meetings. So we'll move into the reports now. And welcome if you have not had a chance to meet or have anything to report out, that's okay. So we'll jump right in here and I'll call on the student assembly.
Hi everyone, it's so nice to be back. I have two resolutions that we had after the last UA meeting at Student Assembly. First is resolution number 35, which is Cornell to eliminate legacy preferences. And that has been submitted to the president. And then resolution number 37, which is what we were working on the entire year, which is the student activity fee in the byline for the byline cycle, that was accepted by the president.
Thank you, Ellie. Any questions? No? All right, appreciate that. Next one, the GPSA.
Yeah, good to see everybody. Glad to be back. We haven't had our first meeting yet. We have it next Monday night. But
okay, sorry, you cut out there for a moment. I think you said you haven't had a chance to meet. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. Just want to note that I'm assuming that we probably have someone who helps to let folks know when things happen here, and that the announcement of the appointment of the ombudsperson has been released in the Cornell Chronicle. So I've linked the article there for folks to have that available. All right, and then next up we have the Employee Assembly, I believe. Sorry, I moved between screens. So, yes. Employee Assembly.
Yeah, thank you. So the Employee Assembly, we had our spring semester meeting with President Pollack and Vice President Opperman last week. And they talked through beginning of semester plans and answered questions, most of which were around how is this semester going to start and pandemic concerns. At the moment, we're scheduling a meeting with Russell Reynolds, the firm that's been retained in the search for the new Chief Human Resources Officer. The president has asked them to meet with the Employee Assembly, so at the moment, we're working on finding a time. A couple things that committees have been doing since we last met. The Employee Welfare Committee is working on a resolution regarding employee onboarding. The Communications Outreach and Recognition Committee is reviewing 14 nominations for the award for staff integrity and inclusion. And the Education and Development Committee, which is chaired by Marcy, received an update about the employee degree program from the Director of HR Analytics. There were 35 staff members completed their degrees in 2021, which is one of the best years for that program. So those are our updates.
Thank you, Jessica. Anyone have any questions for Jessica? All right, with that, I'll recognize Eve for the Faculty Senate.
Hello, everyone. We had our December faculty Senate meeting after the UA had closed down for the fall semester. And in that Senate meeting, we had two proposals that the university is thinking about, and we're getting feedback from multiple Senate committees. One of the proposals that we're thinking about and vetting for the university is a proposal to have a part-time bachelor's degree for non-traditional students. And this was pitched as a equity issue. And then the other presentation, again, from the undergrad education program is rethinking the honors and distinctions for Cornell undergraduates. And that resolution was actually revised with the Education Policy Senate Committee. And that resolution recognized that there's uneven application of honors and distinctions across the colleges. And so the resolution is to come up with one university-wide nomenclature and criteria for achieving honors and distinctions and getting rid of the dean's list. And so we will have Senate committees come back and discuss those things before the Senate comes back and votes on them this spring. And that's it.
Thank you. I have a question myself in regards to the bachelor's, the non-traditional bachelor's program. So that would be to address folks being able to perhaps working a full-time job, looking to achieve their bachelor's. Has there been conversation around that being something available to Cornell employees as well?
Yes, the assumption is that is available to employees.
That's a great initiative. I'd love to keep up to date on how that's coming along. Thank you very much.
We're also considering the prison population. They have a very successful associate degree. And so this is one possible mechanism to allow for a bachelor's degree for prison. And the military.
Great. Thank you so much, Eve. Someone else had their hand up and then put it down. Maybe I'll recognize Jacob and then I'll go to Duncan.
Yeah, I'm just curious, you know, as to getting rid of the dean's list distinction. What's the, for lack of a better term, what's the logic behind that?
Because there's a very big difference between how it's applied. So certain colleges, you can have like 60-75% of the students reaching the dean's list, and then another college, it could be something like 15%. And so because of those extremes, they're trying to think of ways to, as a university, just have honors and distinctions to be the same criteria and applied universally. It's not a done deal yet.
My only question about that is, you know, I understand, you know, changing the way that we apply dean's lists, but getting rid of it lock, stock, and barrel, that, I don't know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Perhaps applying it differently depending on, you know, how many credits you take. You know, certainly somebody taking 12 credits and gets a 4.0 is much different than somebody taking 25 credits and 4.0.
So the honors that they're proposing will be GPA based. That's actually the criterion now. So it's almost like it's replacing the dean's list. It just won't be every semester, but ultimately at the end of your career, you would achieve it through either 5%, 10%, or 15%. But those would be the students that you'd get the honor.
I hate to jump in front of Duncan one more time and ask a follow-up question with that. But also, I think that, you know, of course, I was not in the conversations regarding any of this, but I feel that it may actually put Cornell students at a potential disadvantage in terms of summer internship and employment opportunities when other colleges are giving out dean's list distinctions per semester, and every single Cornell student does not have any dean's list listed, it could end up undermining our students' ability to gain access to high-profile internships and employment opportunities that they need in order to advance their education.
But I think their argument is because one college has that and another one does not, then if they can just say Cornell as a blanket policy does not do this, then it shouldn't disadvantage students. But I can also ask that this come to the GPSA and the student assembly. Wow.
Thank you for the questions, Jacob, and the answers there, Eve. Recognize Duncan.
thank you, Eve, first for sharing this. I had a lot of very similar questions to Jacob, and so I appreciate getting those answered. One of my first immediate thoughts of this was I would love if you could either present or this could be brought up to the student assembly. Obviously, I understand the interests of the faculty senate here, and I think it's really imperative that there is definitely a sensible structure here that works for all parties. And I'm really happy that the Faculty Senate's taking a look at that. I think it's just important in this, the point exactly Jacob made, I think, which is just, you know, recognizing how inconsistencies in this could affect employment for students, as well as how a big, broad, school-wide change could have consequences within specific recruitment cycles currently going on. The example I always kind of jump to, which is it's a little overplayed in my school in ILR, but right now Deloitte is doing recruitment for freshmen. So they're doing a freshman case competition that then turns into a sophomore internship that then you hope by your junior year as an internship that could lead to an offer. These are students who likely haven't even taken financial accounting or courses relevant to this. But a possible switch of dean's list here, a possible switch of honors in these programs, I can't predict what it would look like, but obviously there'd be a lot of student concern and confusion with this. So I'd love if we could possibly open the floor to a presentation from the UA about this and maybe coming to the student assembly about it, and of course the GPSA as well. So I think there's a lot of student leaders who'd be very, very interested in learning more about this.
And I encourage everyone to go to the Faculty Senate December 8th website, and you'll see there's a slide deck there, the proposals are there, and then the conversation, that the 20-minute conversation in the Senate is there for everyone to listen to as well.
That'd be great to look into. Thank you, Eve, and I'm looking forward to learning more about this soon.
Thank you very much. Any more questions for Eve? Okay, as we move into committee reports, we have just a few minutes left. So I would just ask if there are committees that do have reports. I do know that James Richards was unable to make it this evening due to delays in his flight, so we don't have one from the Codes and Judicial Committee. Jacob, I don't know if there's anything you'd like to provide from the Executive Committee.
No, just looking forward to continuing an awesome semester. Okay. Stay safe, everyone.
Thank you, Jacob. And then the Campus Welfare Committee.
I have a couple of updates. We had our spring semester kickoff meeting yesterday. On Monday, we have a resolution that we're drafting to bring forward about in support of a new natatorium at Cornell. We have a draft. I'm going to work with Gina on it next and then send it out for vetting. We are also drafting a memo, basically, to the Student Assembly and the GPSA, asking if they'd like to collaborate with us on a resolution or something around campus welfare as it relates to, in response to the campus crises from last semester. There was talk about how do we support campus during and after a crisis, and what resources are there, and how are we disseminating that information. So briefly, that's what we're up to.
Thank you very much, Deborah. Any questions for Deborah? No. And before we jump to the Infrastructure Tech Committee, perhaps I would entertain a motion to extend just a few moments so we don't go past the 6 o'clock mark without an extension, just to give Ian time to not have to rush in less than 60 seconds.
Motion to extend by 5 minutes.
We have a motion to extend by 5 minutes. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a second. All right. Any objections? All right. Seeing none, I'll recognize Ian to give us an update on CITE.
Good afternoon, everybody. Really quick, next Tuesday, SITE will be having a somewhat special committee meeting because it will be open to all members of the assemblies, and it will involve presentations, one facilitated by the Campus Sustainability Office, involving R5 operations and Beyond Waste to address the ongoing initiatives they have right now towards managing waste and recycling on campus. Followed by those presentations, a representation from the Big Belly Company will actually be presenting. For those of you who were at the final meeting of the fall semester, you might remember there was some discussion about UA Resolution Number 3, which involved updates to the waste and recycling infrastructure on campus. So a representative from Big Belly will be giving a presentation on the various waste solutions they offer and what they might be able to do for Cornell. I know one question in specific that was asked last meeting was answered during my initial conversation with the representative, which is what happens when the waste receptacles get snow on them in cold weather climates. There actually is a plan for that. So I will promulgate the formal agenda for the meeting, as well as the Zoom link to the assembly's distro. And I hope everybody who's able to make it can come.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for organizing that presentation for folks and inviting the entire assembly to join that presentation. I really appreciate you making that available for folks. We had hoped to bring them here to present to the UA, but the timing was going to push it out quite far. So I appreciate you being flexible to have them present there, and would encourage folks to take Ian up on that opportunity to hear from R5 as well as the Big Belly company on that process. Are there any questions the assembly has for Ian? All right. Well, seeing none, as Ian has noted there, that all assemblies are welcome, not just for those members of the UA, but if you have members in the other assemblies in the Senate that are interested in attending, Ian will make sure to get that Zoom link out to folks to be able to attend the presentation. So thank you, Ian, for extending that invite to everyone. All right. With that, we do have a few minutes left. We'll open if there are any other questions or comments before we close. All right, seeing that, I'll just state that I hope we all have the opportunity to meet in person at our next next meeting, and hoping that things do shift in a good direction here. I know that I'm looking forward to having us all together, and hopefully being able to, as well as to Richard's point, be able to have some food at our meetings. We'd love to get that going again. If we get a clock and a food, I'll feel like we were really successful in this few sessions. But I just want to acknowledge as well for folks that we want you all to continue your great work, continue to bring forth resolutions and ideas, continue the work in the committees. That's what drives our advocacy for our constituency groups, and really drives the change that we have the opportunity to make within the university and advocate for. And know that I am here to support you in any way that I can, and don't hesitate to reach out to me if you have questions, thoughts, or concerns. I'm happy to hear those. I'm very happy we were able to have Professor Lewenstein appointed this evening. Look forward to your work there. Thank you so much for joining us for our assembly meeting, and thank you all so much. And with that, I would entertain a motion to adjourn our meeting.
Motion to adjourn.
Thank you, Richard. Motion to adjourn. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Second by Jessica. Thank you, Jessica. Any objections? And seeing none, everybody stay safe, stay warm, and see you all hopefully at the CITE presentation, or if not, at the next UA mini meeting. Take care, everyone. Have a good evening.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.